Hello, this is Kevin Doherty, your host for Just Thinking. Today, I have a really wonderful guest, someone that I met through another podcast with a friend of mine, Fons, who does My EdTech Life. So if you've not followed My EdTech Life yet, you need to do so. But through that podcast, I met Dr. Michelle Amet. And Michelle, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Absolutely. We didn't even rehearse it, and you nailed it.
Thank you so much. All those linguistics courses have paid off. So thank you so much. Michelle, why don't you tell folks a little bit about who you are and your background?
Hi, everyone. It is a pleasure to be here today, Kevin. I'm Michelle Amet, and I am the co-president of the Human Intelligence Movement. And today we're going to talk a little bit about what is this movement, why it exists, and what we aim to do. I also am the chief academic officer of ProSolve, and ProSolve is a human skills curriculum company. We design learning experiences that really build the essential human skills students need in today's world. And those two roles that I do have been heavily influenced by my background as a career educator. I was an elementary school teacher for a number of years, a building leader as a curriculum coordinator and also a principal, and then also at the district level where I served in roles around personalizing learning, curriculum learning and assessment, all of those really important aspects of leading a school district for a number of years. So all of those experiences for the last, I think, Kevin, it's a close to almost 30 years in public education,
Wow. Really
bringing that into these two roles that I have with Human Intelligence Movement and ProSolve.
Well, you have a fascinating background, Michelle, and we have a lot of similar experiences professionally leading up to this as well. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Human Intelligence Movement. So what is the mission of this organization?
The mission of the movement is to ensure that all students have the human skills, the human intelligences that they need for an AI integrated world. We, Travis Allen is the co-president of the Human Intelligence Movement, and together we started this movement. It's a grassroots nonprofit organization that really is designed to do three things: to amplify awareness around the need to prioritize human intelligence in an AI world. We have a community of over 700 people coming together to share their ideas and their best practices around how to do that. So that element of a community, being part of something, having that human connection is one of our goals and one of our missions. And then through that community and that awareness building, what we really want to advocate is something different in education. How can we reimagine what learning looks like in an age of AI? And so we have our third mission is to really advocate for change. And that change could be something at a school level, at a district level, at a state level, or a national policy level.
I love that. So I don't want to take this negative at all, but I do want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you see moving forward as we're working to better prepare students to thrive in an AI environment.
Well, I appreciate that idea of staying positive, because I think our world has enough kind of negative ideas, but I think it's important to sort of center ourselves on what has been a flaw in our educational system. And before I kind of dive in with some of my thoughts, I just want to name that I am talking about a real systems level. Like, I think our teachers come to work every day and they're doing the best that they can for the students they serve. But the system, the structure that we've put in place has really made it difficult for teachers, for principals, and even superintendents to really create the conditions for school that need to happen for today's world. And so I think one of the biggest things that our system is stuck in is this knowledge era. So our current system was built during the industrial age. When we started to shift to an industrial world with a factory model, we created an education system that matched that. We needed a pathway for workers at the time and to equip them with knowledge. And that factory model style of learning has really stuck around. And quite frankly, it's outdated for today's world. We no longer live in a knowledge era because we live in an AI era. And all of the information, all of the knowledge is at our fingertips. And so now it's really about shifting our thinking and our approach to an application of that knowledge. How do we create conditions for in our education system for students to apply what they know, use what they know, problem solve, and think critically using that knowledge and information versus acquiring information and knowledge, which has been really our current practices. And over my years in education, I've watched this kind of, I guess what I want to say, Kevin, is that this is nothing new. We've been talking about this for a number of years.
Yep.
And I've watched kind of this tug and pull between wanting to do things differently. But I think with this rise of AI, now it is paramount that we really think differently about what our system is, how our system is built and what our students need, especially as we look ahead to the workforce. What we continue to hear from a myriad of reports, the need for workers to have graduates coming out of high school to have more of these human intelligences, these skills to have a conversation, be able to collaborate, be able to think critically. All of those human skills are needed more and more in our workplace. And we hear that from employers and business leaders, yet we continue to our system continues to hold itself accountable to how much you know, how much knowledge you have, and how that's assessed on a standardized test. And so all of this has to change.
Yes. So when you mentioned assessment, I can remember vividly, it was probably about 25 years ago, I was at a national, international ASCD conference, and all the big gurus in education were on the stage for an expert panel. We were having this same discussion,
right?
And so, but one of the conclusions that was drawn by this group was the fact that all of it is driven by assessment, that until and if that changes, the system as it's designed will continue to run and you know, function the way that it has up to this point. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, our systems are perfectly designed to get the results that they are designed to get. And I agree. I think assessment is the driving force, because that's, you know, we measure, like, we need to start measuring what matters, and we aren't doing that. We're continuing to measure in a way that that is about knowledge acquisition. And I think that's why I think big about the entire accountability system, about what we're holding schools at, what we're holding states accountable for, what we're holding schools accountable for. And, you know, I think about the times where I was a district administrator holding principals and teachers accountable to that standardized Minnesota accountability measure. And it just, I no wonder they couldn't do anything different in their classrooms or in their schools, because that was held over them as a mark of success, rather than really thinking about, okay, we're helping create humans here. And what does it mean to measure human potential in a different way than just an IQ score? What can it mean to think about how they are adaptable, how they have emotional intelligence? And that's really what the human intelligence movement is calling for, is a different way of really measuring these human intelligences, and also a different way of ensuring that they're part of a student's learning journey.
As you're mentioning all that, it's taking me back to my days as a principal. And I was a principal in two different districts, but most of my experience was in the Houston area in a Title I school. All my kids were bused in from various apartment complexes. And at the time I took over as principal, we were probably the third lowest of like 30 some elementary schools in terms of academic performance. But of course I wanted the scores to get up. I would have loved our school to be at the top score wise. There were a lot of variables and a lot of things that I had to address to get there. But a couple of the activities that I brought to the school were things like we had the very first student-run bank. Mm-hmm. So our fifth graders ran the bank. A local bank came to us and they said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? Absolutely. The little kids would save their change after lunch and they would deposit it. And then every Friday they would come and collect it. Kids did all the record keeping and accounting. And I thought, that's real world. Totally. That was motivational. It was exciting. You know, starting the first Destination Imagination team that the school ever had, winning the regional competition. Now, our scores probably made it up to about middle in the 3 years that I was principal there. But I have to honestly say, the pressure on my shoulders from above was bottom line scores. None of these other activities or focus on building community and building those human intelligence skills were spotlighted or got the focus until after I left. Then in hindsight, we look back on those things and say, wow, you know, we were doing some really innovative, wonderful things. And the culture was just so engaging and inclusive and that sort of thing. But at the time, you know, it was a real tug of war for me as the principal, as the leader of that campus. So would you speak to that a little bit? Because there's some practicalities and realities that these leaders are dealing with going forward.
Absolutely. I think that I think about a couple of things. In my perfect world, I would release that pressure on principals and site leaders. And until the system starts to release the pressure for superintendents, I'm not sure that that will happen, right? So that's why I think it's so important for us to be reevaluating what's important right now in our world. And I'm very curious about all of the changes that are happening in the Department of Education and what outcomes may exist as a result of this time. And so, I want to name that the pressure is real. And Kevin, I think your story is spot on. I think that what I heard you do is bring in some places where there is that opportunity for student-driven learning, for experiential learning. I mean, having kids own something and run a bank like that is an amazing real-world opportunity. And so I think one of the things I would say to principals is really thinking about places where you can bring innovation into your school. So, and giving teachers freedom and autonomy and permission to do what they do best and be able to release the pressure on that covering content, getting through the scope and sequence and finding those pockets of innovation where you can bring some experiential learning in where it becomes a more student-centered approach. And it may be that, you know, my dream would be every minute of the school day is like that for kids. Sure. And I'm sure you'd agree. And at some point, it's about doing something. So starting small with something, whether it's a unit of study or a subject area, that there's just a little bit more flexibility and the opportunity to bring that experiential learning into the classroom. I really believe strongly in learning by doing. And through ProSolve, our curriculum that we create is all focused on hands-on, game-based experiential learning, where kids are working in teams and collaborative structures to do things together. Learning is social, so making that human-to-human connection really part of their experience, and then giving them tough problems to solve, things that are meaningful and relevant to them, goes a long way. So what we want to start doing is having kids say less about, why do I have to learn this? Why do I have to know this information? Why do I have to go to school? And instead, they are really inspired to be there. They're engaged because what they are focused on means something to them, and they're seeing an impact an impact or a direct correlation to what they're doing.
I love that. You know, it takes me back to my graduate school studies. And At that point, I was introduced to a quote by John Dewey that everybody in education now knows: school is not just preparation for life, school is life. So when we're talking about assessment, a lot of times it's focused on getting them ready for, or college readiness, getting them ready for. And if you've ever had the experience like I did as an elementary teacher, where I lost a student in a tragic car accident, if I think, oh, everything was about getting that student ready for the next grade level or for the state assessment or for college, and that's all I focused on. That was my focus as an educator, was getting them ready for that and working towards some future goal way down the road or several months down the road. And did take some time just to enjoy today.
Right.
So speaking of that, one of your other areas of focus that I understand is addressing the urgent need to reimagine education for the AI era. So we just talked about that, you know, we've sat in these conferences, we've had these same conversations for 2+ decades. How do we spark a flame that gets this urgency, more prevalent and moves things forward? What do we do to address the systemic issue that exists?
That is a great question. And I get asked a lot, like, okay, we're all bought in. This is what we need to do now. How do we do it? And I think one of the things that is to really spark curiosity. I think kids are innately and naturally curious, and leading with some of that curiosity is something that we don't do enough of in education right now. What is the big overarching question that we want to tackle? And then what are the things each student might be curious about and want to explore? So that starts to really get students focused on what, again, is meaningful to them, what are they curious about, and what that looks like then is a lot of different learning pathways. So no longer are you universally all learning the same information. Of course, it ties back to the same big idea, but rather each student is really on their own, charting their own course, or a small group of students exploring and using, you know, whether it's project-based learning or inquiry-based learning, trying to discover and find those answers rather than that teacher being that kind of smartest person in the room, bringing the information to the students. The students just sitting back and kind of consuming that information. I have a 24-year-old who recently said to me, "Mom, I don't really know how to create anything." And I thought that was a really profound statement, because he has been a consumer of information, whether it is through, you know, his personal social media and so on. He's part of that generation where social media really impacted him. And so consuming that, but also a consumer in K-12 education. Like, he sat and consumed information and passively learned versus being given a problem to solve and then the teacher getting out of the way and allowing students the opportunity to really struggle with that question, struggle to find the answer, and really create something as a result of what they are learning. And I think if we go back to assessment, because I think it's an underlying topic in this conversation, it's, you know, that assessment of learning versus the assessment for learning. And I think that idea of we gotta get them ready for the assessment, we gotta get to the end of the unit test, that's that assessment of learning. We need more of just that assessment for learning and having students self-reflect, really be metacognitive of what they are learning, and that kind of learning along the way, that learning by doing versus taking in a lot of information to get to the end and then show me what you know.
Michelle, it's so funny, because my next item that I was going to ask you to address was, how do we focus on the shift from passive learning to active application of knowledge? And I think you've already answered that, but excuse me, any more on that?
I think that passive to active, I think it's about the approach, right? We've got to throw the textbooks out the window and instead create more hands-on experiential learning, like you mentioned about the bank scenario, and things that scenarios where we immerse kids into real life problem solving. And, you know, the best example is when we actually bring the real world into our classrooms and have students solve real world problems. That can, I think, both lead to that idea of active learning. I think mm-hmm. about when I was a fifth grade teacher, we were a magnet school, and we had an international studies like fair each year, you know, where different groups would come and show what they had learned. And so my class really wanted to make an impact in another country around the world. So we decided to make these bracelets and sell them at this fair. And the money would then go to buy a menagerie of animals. Like, they were so set on how they wanted to get this menagerie. They didn't just want the single animal, they wanted the menagerie, which I think is a cool word to say. But anyway, that project, like, that was so motivating. Kids would come every day and they'd be like, okay, Mrs. Amon, what are we going to do today? Or they'd come up to me, we are not going to have enough bracelets. I can tell that there are a lot of people that want to buy these bracelets at this event, and we are not going to have enough. What are we going to do? And rather than me solve the problem for them, I would say, well, what do you think we should do? How are we going to solve this problem? And so I saw kids fully invested in the outcome. They were owning their learning at this place. They were problem solving, and they as a class community, they were tapping into their assets and strengths. There was a group that was doing the marketing efforts. There was a group doing the research on the donation process and what the menagerie we should purchase. There was group that was actually creating these bracelets. There was the group that was working on the math around what is going to be our return on investment. And so those real world problem solving skills are something that stick with learners far more than if I covered content in a textbook. And, you know, I'd argue probably that, I'd be curious what you think about this, but your school in Houston where you saw the scores go up, I wonder how much of that was because you created the conditions for more engagement, for students to learn through problem solving, and if there was more of a correlation in the type of learning that you brought in versus your teachers doing a better job covering.
That's a great question. And I imagine there were elements of both that led to the result, a little bit more focus on what we're doing assessment wise. But I definitely think it was the other things. But there was one more layer that I brought into that school. And I can't take really much of any credit for it, except making the decision to move forward with it. It was our special programs department, federal programs, that came to me and said, hey, Kevin, we've got $10,000. To spend, it's a grant, on building a family parent center. Would you be interested? Well, my school was not a neighborhood school. I served about a third of my student population were Hispanic. Many of the parents were non-English speaking parents. Very self-conscious coming to school, didn't feel comfortable coming into the school environment, often had other kids in tow. And it was like, okay, what can we do? We took that $10,000 and we built a home within the school. Oh. And another principal suggested, Kevin, do not put it off in a portable or off in some old, you know, janitor closet and clean it up and make it, put it in the heart of your school. So I found space in the heart of the school. We bought a sofa, rugs, television, things, coffee making machine, all different things to make it as homey as possible. And parents could come there and they could do things like put the Friday folders together or help cut out some different things for the classrooms or whatever the teachers needed assistance with. But they would sit in there and they built community. And every Thursday they invited me to lunch and they brought food from home. So whatever their food was from home is what they brought. So there was a cultural component to it with the food. And when I left that that school to move to another city and school to be principal, that was the thing I was most proud of. And the thing that I think had the greatest impact on the overall culture of the school, because by them being there, we could talk about these matters and they were totally bought in. And they were the clients, if you will. They were, it was their kids, it was their community school. We were building the sense of community and they felt ownership. Mm-hmm. And that moved the needle dramatically. So when I said, hey, we're going to do a banquet, we'd love it. Hey, Kevin, can we do a ribbon cutting? And can we bring pictures? Yes. Can we bring our kids? Yes. Mm-hmm. Bring them all in. Let's make this a big celebration and get it in the newspaper and just, you know, celebrate all the wonderful things that our kids are doing that don't get celebrated very often. So yes, yes, and yes to your question. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think those things impacted student performance significantly.
Well, and it just sounds like that is the epitome of human-centered leadership. You really put the humans at the center and understood what their needs were and thought about how do I create this inclusive community that brings people together around what matters most. And so does that culture still exist in the school?
You know, I think the family center remained. It's been many years since I was there. I actually was able to take the concept to my next school and district and build it there. What I've noticed happen over time is a little bit of a reverting back to focus on, I'm not saying my old school specifically necessarily, but a reverting back to the focus on assessment. My great hope was coming out of COVID that we would see a dramatic shift in everything, because we had the opportunity to rethink everything, including the systems and the structures, right? And yet what I've witnessed is, you know, a kind of shifting back to what's comfortable and safe. And maybe that's part of the process, is that pendulum swing kind of, you know, goes the way it does. But it's my hope that through conversations like this, through organizations, grassroots movements like the Human Intelligence Movement, that we can breathe some of that that vision and right. some of that excitement back into our schools.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the goal of the Human Intelligence Movement is really to create this rallying cry in education to do something different. We are a movement. We are a set of volunteers coming together to amplify ideas, to kind of make this call for change. We're constantly looking for additional people to join us in the movement and then trying to find those unique partners that really can provide a financial backing or a research entity, something that can really accelerate this change. Because what we've got here is something special. We've mm-hmm. got a lot of educators, administrators, business leaders saying, it is time. Let's seize this opportunity right now in this AI era to really do something different. But it is going to take us coming together and really making a call for change. And so I think as the co-president and the executive director, I'm constantly looking for who else could partner with us? How can we accelerate some of these conversations? Because my biggest fear, and AI is moving so rapidly, is that my biggest fear is a year from now, you and I will have this conversation and we'll be talking about the same thing. Only there is a lot more at stake than ever before. The entire future, our entire humanity, I believe, is at risk if we don't start to really think differently about how we're preparing ourselves to be in this AI world.
Well, Michelle, we're coming to the end of a 30-minute time frame for the episode, and it is somewhat arbitrary, but I try to be respectful of our listeners and or viewers. We're going to continue this conversation because we will not have this conversation a year from now and be having the same conversation we had today. You have my word on that. And I'm totally bought in to this. I was before we had the conversation. I am even more so now. So, Michelle, is there anything else about which you're just thinking, perhaps even, you know, getting some specific information out there to folks that are watching and are viewing? So you get the last word, Michelle.
Hey, the last word. So I would just encourage people to join the movement. You can find us on social media, on LinkedIn, on Instagram, the Human Intelligence Movement. And you can go to our website, humanintelligencemovement.org. It's easy to join this community of people coming together. If you're looking for like-minded thought leaders in this space, it's a great place to build human connection and help us just generate awareness for this message, because we are on a path to make some real change in education. And I'd love to have your listeners join us.
Awesome. Michelle, thanks for being part of Just Thinking today.
Thanks, Kevin.